Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's July 2nd, 2021, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or of course, you can go and find me at overthecap.com for the handful of articles that maybe we'll put out this month. We'll see how busy things get. So no podcast last week. Kind of had a midweek one since the week before I wasn't feeling too well. And then this past weekend was away, and talk a little bit about that in just a little while here. Nelly the Bunny hanging out. Nelly, you got anything? Once again, Nelly has nothing. So I'm sure she'll jump in later on and make some noise drinking water or doing something. Still going on the light beer kick here, so we got the Michelob Ultra for tonight, so it's almost like really kind of drinking nothing, but we've got that going for the podcast. We'll have a couple of those as we get through this one tonight. Hopefully we'll go back to the craft beers maybe within the next month or so. I'm still going to try to lose a little bit of weight here, try to drop down just a little bit further from where we're at. I had a couple days off from the gym. That was pretty rough this morning going back after a week of not eating bad, but not really eating, I guess, great, and probably a little too much drinking here and there. So, you know, that was little adventures this week here. So I think what I wanted to talk about tonight was really two things. One, which will be the second thing I talk about, is the very large contract extension that was signed by Ryan Ramczyk of the New Orleans Saints, which I think has the potential to really be a game-changing kind of contract at that position. I'm not 100% sure on that yet, and it might depend on the timing of a couple of extensions, but I think there's a really interesting dynamic to that deal, and I'll get to that second. The first thing I wanted to talk about a little bit more, I think, is analytics in football. And I know I talked about this a couple of weeks ago a little bit, and I'm probably going to reiterate some of the same points, but what I attended this week, along with doing some stuff with the family, was a little bit of a conference that was related to NFL kind of stuff, and had some really interesting discussions there, met some really interesting people. I was part of one of the panels that just was kind of going over different types of analytics trends in football. And obviously mine is more on the side of contracts, which is a lot different than I think what most people would think of as the typical analytics stuff, which it is. But I think the contracts do play such a big role. One, that there's ways you want to analyze and benchmark your own contracts and try to improve in that regard. But there are ways that we should be and do to some extent kind of merge your statistical performances and analysis with the money aspect of it, because that gets into roster construction. That was basically my role there for a little bit. And I would say our panel, some of it was tongue in cheek, but we'd be, I think, the butt of a lot of jokes there, because it was the dreaded analytics stuff that was there. But that wasn't the point of it. I think it kind of brought to me a little bit more clarity about the adoption of analytics in the NFL, the resistance to it. I guess maybe some of the things that will need to kind of change around the league, probably for it to be adopted a little bit more. So I kind of had the feeling this was, as I was going through the conference, and it was just a two-day thing. And on the second day, really right at the end, I had the privilege of listening to Bill Polian. He commands a room. You know, he's just a lot of interesting stuff as he goes over his career in football, mainly, I think, focusing on his time with Buffalo, but really, really interesting kind of stuff. And it's like I had all these things kind of in my head from before, and then during it, I think, was getting a little bit more clarity on it. And then when he spoke, it was like he made one statement, and it was like a light went off. Like, okay, I've got this now. I kind of really have a little bit better understanding of it. So I kind of was thinking about that from that point on, besides making some trips to Disney as well. So there was running from one thing to the next to do some family stuff. Flying home, I was thinking about this a little bit, and I downloaded Kevin Cole's podcast for the week, just to take a listen to, because I knew he had done a podcast on a comment that Belichick had made the other day. And I'm just going to paraphrase it here, but basically at the, they had a, like a coach, not a coach's, a GM summit or something like that. And Belichick made the comment of he doesn't really care for analytics. Give him a good football player. Give him good execution, yada, yada, yada. That's what he wants. And a lot of people took that to be like, okay, that's Belichick being tongue-in-cheek. Maybe a little bit of it was. And that he's trying to keep like a competitive advantage, you know, and that he's really big into analytics and he believes in it and everything else. So don't listen to him when he says he doesn't check out websites and all that stuff. I'm not really sure if that's the case. I think Belichick was actually being somewhat honest there, and I'll get to that in a second. But I wanted to listen to Kevin's podcast just to make sure I wasn't going to just rehash some of the things he said. And it's really good. Go listen to it. It was mainly focused, though, I think, on the Patriots' adoption of analytics and how they've really changed, I think, in certain areas, as he pointed out, from the – I guess when Brady would have been at his peak to – even though Brady was still having MVP seasons, it was as if there was a shift. You could see that there were changes, whether it was the rest of the league catching up or the Patriots falling back, whatever it was. But anyway, he focused more on the New England aspect of it. But I think what Belichick was really talking about, I think gets to the heart of the matter of some of the analytics debate when it comes to football. One of the things that was brought up during this, during a presentation, there was a discussion about a certain metric that was there that I think it wasn't – I'm not going to call it a grade. It wasn't really a grade, but it was about, you know, how you could assign value to a player. This wasn't a slide that I had prepared, but it was about how you could assign value to a player. The immediate response on it, I think, was, well – and again, I'm going to paraphrase the feedback on it, but it was like, how do you know what the weather was? How do you know if that player was injured? How do you know if, you know, this went on? How do you know if he wasn't feeling well that day? You don't know the play call. You don't know the assignment. You don't know this. You don't, okay. You know, the typical kind of stuff. I kind of wish that I had chimed in a little bit there, even though that wasn't mine, only because the slide was much more of a macro level. It was not talking about individual players. It was talking about positional values. When you do something on a much larger scale like that, you kind of are covering all those variables. Yeah, there's players who are hurt in there. That's also part of assigning the value of a position, right? Does the player is getting hurt a lot at the position? Because that kind of takes away some of the value that's there. But it encompasses all of it. It's like, yeah, you've got guys playing in bad weather. Then you've got guys playing in Atlanta and New Orleans, Minnesota, where they're playing in perfect weather. So there's a lot of things. But when you do that as like an all-encompassing kind of thing, I think that takes a lot of the variance out of it in regards to those individual player metrics. Now, if you were drilling down on an individual player level, I can understand that a little bit. The immediate reaction to it was like, okay, you know, there's obviously the consideration that as an outsider, you don't know the full details. And that's true. But even if you don't know the full details, you don't know them for all 32 teams. So if you're doing something on a 32-team basis, you probably are getting it just as wrong for everyone. So it's almost like there is a correction within that, because you don't know those plays for everybody. You're grading it independently. You're valuing it independently, you know, when it comes down to those things. So that was one of the things. You know, it was very clear that there is a – I'm not saying an us versus them mentality, but there is – and football is notorious for this, all right? Football is notoriously hard to get into. It's very hard to get a job in the NFL. It's very hard to get a job that's actually a good paying job in the NFL. Basically, a lot of people go there and they don't work for a lot of money with the hope that they'll get promoted and get somewhere. Most don't. It's really hard to break in. And I think the league and the people within the league have done a very efficient job at keeping the outside out. That, you know, you've got to know somebody to get in. And it's better now than it was before. But I think that that's definitely a mentality there. You know, what I've done has kind of been unique enough, I think, to where it was never really a concern for anything. And I think because of the way that I wrote about stuff, you kind of gained, I don't know if respect is the word, but I think a belief that, okay, he's not trying to say everything that's done is bad or everything needs to be changed or, you know, it's all just criticism for the sake of criticism to get a click on something. But I still don't work in the NFL. I haven't really pursued it, but I don't work in the NFL. But I do have, I think, a level with, I guess, a lot of teams that, you know, that they at least like the work that I do. But I'm also not going to develop roster building strategies for them either. The second thing that was brought up, and I think this is a legitimate concern among people, partially this comment was not made in the concept of self-preservation, but I do think that that could be some of that as well. But the other comment was had to basically do with the fact that they feel baseball and basketball has basically been ruined by analytics. I kind of agree with that a little bit. I think baseball is a complete bore to watch at this point. I think the availability of statistics there and the way that people have been able to use them to advance the game has made the game, you know, pretty boring. Like there's no unpredictability in it anymore. And you need that kind of unpredictability sometimes to make a game exciting. You know, I think one of the things that makes the NFL exciting is there's only, well, now 17 games, but there's only a handful of games and the games are all meaningful, unlike baseball and basketball. And you do get weeks where you get a bad football team that can upset a good football team. And for whatever reasons that is, you know, it happens. But in the other sports, it really doesn't. And a lot of the games are pretty boring. Baseball definitely is. It's very mechanical. Basketball is to some extent. And this is not to get back into saying that the 90s Knicks were a wonder to watch, that they were a joy to watch. They weren't. It was plodding basketball. It was physical. You know, this isn't about the two-man game or the, you know, the big man game. That's also a pretty boring – that can be a very boring brand of basketball as well. But I think basketball right now resembles more of like a highly skilled pickup game with the approach that's taken than the you know, having something in between what basketball had been during, I guess, the Jordan era and what it ended up as right now, which is just a lot of guys really hanging out at the three-point line and you chuck up shots and then you run back down the floor. And if you have a chance to dunk, you dunk. And if you don't, you're just taking three-pointers. And then there's a couple – you have a couple players that still do have mid-range games, you know, Chris Paul and Kevin Durant and, you know, guys that – a couple of guys that really kind of can break down and create on their own. And you get certain types of team basketball, but it's different, I think, than in the past in terms of being team-oriented basketball. And but a lot of that deals with the fact that shooting a ton of three-pointers is way more efficient and way harder to defend than playing a traditional brand of basketball. And I think there is a fear that if you take some of that excitement out of the NFL, that it could turn into those other sports. And as it is right now, I think it's hard to get younger kids to be invested in really any of the sports, but definitely football. You know, I think football is hard for some younger people to get invested in, especially because there's so much negativity on the physical impacts of the game, you know, dealing with concussions even at a young age and stuff like that. And if you make a game less exciting for younger kids, that's going to hurt your pipeline of talent even more in the future. And then, you know, then there were some other comments as well, you know, about different things. But then as you listen to some of the same people give speeches, or get, not speeches, but be part of discussions, you know, concepts come up where you'll talk about processing time, for example. You know, that you, in this case, the story had to do with a specific player that basically the team, what they valued at this position was they thought someone that was able to process a lot of information and give it back was going to make them a high-level player. So they developed essentially a metric, analytics, that basically said this about a particular position. And then they realized that maybe they had to adjust that because it's one thing to be able to teach something. It's one thing to be able to regurgitate something, understand something, say something. And it's another thing to be able to process that in 2 seconds and implement it in a play. And maybe that's also a concern with analytics as well, that there's a fear that if you take some of these things on, you've only got 5 seconds to make a play call, 10 seconds, whatever it is, that you don't have the time to factor that in. So, you know, I'm listening to this and I'm like, you know, what they're talking about when it comes to that is essentially analytics. When they talk about drafting, draft grades, for example, that you can't have a draft grade on a player, anything solid, until you get into, you know, medicals and all that stuff. That's all, in a sense, some of that's all analytics, you know, that, you know, you need the measurements, you need medicals, you need to see them in person to do this test and that test and another test, and you need psychological exams, you need all these things. It's just sitting there and it's like, gosh, you know, all that stuff that's being talked about is analytics. Now, that's not to say that this applies to every organization, that there are teams that are very willing to take input from the outside and implement it, you know, utilize your pro football focus groups and your football outsiders beyond using it for cut-ups of video and just random statistics that you're looking at. There are teams that do that, you know, the Eagles, the Browns, the Ravens. I think the Colts fall into that category. You know, there's teams that fall into that. But I think it's a small percentage of the league, I think. You know, there might be some teams that give lip service to it, but I think it's a small percentage that really implement it. And then there's some that are probably very negative on it. So I'm listening to all this and I'm listening to people essentially talk about analytics, you know, talk about, you know, putting a color on a draft card to indicate the level of player and the number grade that they're giving on a player. It's like that's all part of an analytics process, you know. And then Bill Polian gave his speech. You know, Polian has pretty much been on the record many, many, many times that, you know, forget this analytics stuff, you know, this running backs don't matter stuff and anything with, you know, these number crunchers that haven't played football and, you know, aren't involved in the game. And, you know, don't give me that stuff. You know, I had Thurman Thomas and, you know, he was a damn good running back, you know, that kind of stuff. As he's giving this wonderful talk about everything, he starts talking about how in Buffalo, you know, and I'm sure that he's done this many times, so I don't think I'm giving any secret stuff away. He talks about how they were looking for kind of high character players. They didn't want to have a room of players who were kind of risky personalities to upset the apple cart, immature players, players that they had to carry along, players they had to bring along. So he talked in that about basically having, I think it was his sister, and I might have that wrong, but, you know, he looked at it like, okay, I don't know anything about behavioral health, but I think this might be important for our team. So he goes to someone that he trusts, someone who knows about behavioral health, and basically says, is there a way that we can determine if these players are a good fit, a non-fit, or maybe a good fit, you know, something along those lines. Of course. Sure. And he's very proud of the fact that they were, in his mind, in his opinion, probably the first team to ever introduce like a psychological exam or a psychological profile of a player as part of the draft process. I don't think it applied to free agency. It might have, but as part of that. And I'm sitting there, and then it's just like he's talking about analytics. He's talking about this thing that he says you don't do, you don't touch. It's stupid. It's a waste of time. He was doing it 30 years ago, right? And I think the issue with a lot of the analytics in the NFL right now is the teams have always had control of everything. Like I said, it's a very close-knit fraternity. It's very hard to break in, whether it's into a front office, whether it's a coaching position, a scouting position, whatever it may be. It's hard to break in. I'm listening to it all, and it kind of got to me that I think there is a fear in the NFL that you've got outside people utilizing the same tape that is watched by the people who work in the NFL, utilizing the same basic statistics that are utilized in the NFL, by the NFL, have always been. And yeah, are there some new twists on it? Yeah, sure. Yeah, you throw an elusive rating in there. Yeah, sure. That's a little bit different. You know, you're categorizing pressures, even though you can get 8 million different versions of a pressure depending on the source you use. Okay. You're using the same basic kind of stuff that they do, and they don't control it. And I think there's a fear that when you get into the baseball and the basketball, the analytical control you, that you're going to have someone that doesn't have experience in this is going to try to come up with something to essentially pigeonhole you into a decision, tell you, you have to do this on fourth down. You have to do this on third down. You have to pass every play. Forget about the run. You should never draft a running back. You should never sign a running back. In fact, there's no point in having a running back on the roster. You will go through all that. And in their mind, they're 100 times more qualified to work with those kind of numbers, work with those kind of statistics, and develop their own metrics to work with, utilizing data and keeping it in-house. Because I think from the league perspective, from a team perspective, all it boils down to is they want to control the analytic. They want to have ownership of whatever the decision-making process is. They want to have ownership of the way that you can manipulate data, the way that you can work with data, and the way that maybe you can find different little hidden trends in data to work with. And that was really, I think, my big takeaway from it. It's like, I think if you could hold somebody's hand and walk them into a metric, whatever that metric may be. I'll just talk about the OTC stuff. You know, walk somebody into the concept of what we have with evaluation on a player. Hold their hand into it and let them kind of take that metric and look at it. Maybe modify it a little bit, make it their own a little bit, and then they probably maybe use it. But I think that's a big thing with it. And I think that's why a lot of teams right now, if you look at teams that – there's some teams that have very big analytics departments or have bigger analytics departments. But a lot of those analytics staff sometimes are just kind of like other people who have been working in other functional areas within the NFL. And it's like, okay, well, we'll give them an analytics title now. I think there's some of that that goes on. And I think the latest trend in hiring has to do with a lot of people that are coming from Big Data Bowl. Now, I don't know how much they're utilizing the talent right now, but I think it's a rush to get talent, not so much because they anticipate those people making an independent contribution. And I could be wrong on that. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you have new data sets coming in because you have all this tracking technology. And the people who have competed in the Big Data Bowl have already shown an ability to work with that tracking technology. And that's kind of like a new frontier right now in what could be done. And by hiring them, you're keeping it in-house. You're letting whatever get tinkered with. But at the end of the day, I think what it boils down to is your general managers, assistant general managers, head coaches are going to be have those people as part of their staff to ask them to do things that they want to see done. Not to necessarily have something that's done independently, not to necessarily have something that's done without the input of higher up levels directing the process. And I really do. I think after this, I really think that that's the biggest thing with it, is that there is a just a perception that it has to be done by the organization and it can't be done from the outside. You know, it can't be Moneyballed in a book, you know, and then you hire somebody there who helps build that out. And then the disciples of the book and whatever else get hired at other organizations and it takes over a sport. I think the feeling is just that you work within your own things. I did talk with some people there and say, I don't think the way the NFL is that it could ever be like baseball and like basketball. One, there's too few games. There's too much randomness that occurs. You are always going to have to make your own decisions. That there's, you're not going to always be able to do everything by the numbers. I don't think you get enough opportunities to maybe have that balance out. You know, in baseball, the season's so long, so many pitches, so many at-bats, so much this, so much that. It is all going to balance out. In the NFL, you know, if you have a game where you're wiping out a team, who cares if you convert a couple fourth downs there? It doesn't make a difference. You know, the problem becomes in those close games, you don't get enough fourth down opportunities probably for it to balance out within that game where it's meaningful. Yeah, maybe it's going to balance out over the course of 17 games, but you need them to balance out in the right situation. So I get that. And, you know, the thing that I try to always bring up when talking with people, I think a little bit about it, is that when you get into analytics and you get into people from the outside talking about it, all it is probabilities. It's not saying you have to do it. It's just saying this is information that might be important. This is information that you should want when you're making your decision. And I know there's some concern about the speed of the game. You can develop tools very easily that, you know, give you those answers right away as soon as a situation pops up, if you're talking about in-game. You know, I always liken it, and I think I've used this example on this before, on this podcast before. I always liken it to the concept of like mutual funds, or your retirement accounts. You know, if you're lucky enough to have a little bit of money saved up for retirement, you know, there's usually two ways that you can kind of go with it. I mean, I guess there's a couple other ways, but, you know, one of the ways is you can invest in mutual funds where basically you're letting someone, quote unquote, control the analytic for you, right? They've developed what is their least risky model that's supposed to maximize your return while minimizing your risk. And you're going to put your money in that, and your goal is to outperform, you know, the S&P benchmarks or whatever, depending on what you put it in. And there's different funds that you can, you know, you take on a little bit more risk, you take on a little bit less risk. But that's essentially, you know, what you're doing. You're putting your trust in the outside to do that. Your other thing that you can do with it is you can kind of choose your own stocks. You know, you can choose what you want to invest your money in. Yeah, and this doesn't apply just to retirement. I just use it as retirement there because that's I guess that's the main way that I have a little bit to play with. You basically create your own portfolio at that point, and you determine your own risk assessment on that. And there's a million different tools that you can utilize to help you determine how much risk that you want to take on, right? There's a million different things that are all metrics. Analytics of sorts that have been developed by other people that are just accepted as being useful. How useful? That's up to you. You can determine how much you use them or how much you don't. You know, whether you're talking about different indicators, you're talking about, you know, your moving averages, you're talking about coefficients, you're talking about all these things. You utilize them and you kind of create your own set of outcomes. And it's no different. It shouldn't be any different in the NFL. You're controlling the analytic the same way you're controlling your portfolio by doing your own investments in the stock, but you're still using outside sources to help you make those decisions. You shouldn't just be fearful of it. You shouldn't just be dismissive of it. That's not to say that people were dismissive at this at all. They weren't. But just that you should be listening to it, you should read it, think about it, and see maybe if there's something you can implement. And even if you don't want to take it from, again, you know, I think that the bigger groups for this would be PFF and Football Outsiders, and they do two very different things. You know, if you don't want to take stuff from there, you can still utilize those concepts to bring back to your people in-house, control your own metric, and develop your own risk assessments. You know, I think the overconfidence that occurs in the NFL is, it's definitely something. I see it all the time with contracts, you know, running back contracts being the main one. It's like, I'm not telling you to not re-sign your running back. I'm just telling you the odds that it will or won't work out. That's all. But the problem is, everyone is so overconfident, you can give a number, and the immediate reaction is, well, not me. You know, the Panthers said not me with Christian McCaffrey. He played, what, 3 games last year? Now maybe he'll bounce back. Maybe he'll be perfectly fine. The Jets said not me with Le'Veon Bell. He sucked. Cowboys said not me with Ezekiel Elliott. They pretty much had him on the bench at points last year. You know, the Saints said not me with Alvin Kamara. It's okay. We'll see how things go. Titans said not me with Derrick Henry. He was great last year. Bengals said not me with Joe Mixon. He was hurt. Cardinals said it with David Johnson. He stunk. So the point is, while you're saying that you're the exception to the rule is only created because all these other teams thought they were the exception to the rule. They were all the rule. You will probably be the rule, but I'm not telling you not to do it. I'm just saying there's probably about a 20% chance it works out. That's all. You determine the amount of risk you want to take. It's the same thing when I would talk about the Jets trade up for a guard. I was very negative on it. But the feedback that you get on it, even when you try to discuss it, is, you know, this guy from over the cap needs to just stay in his salary lane. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Talk contracts. You don't know football. Joe Douglas knows football. Don't disagree with that, that Joe Douglas knows football. There's 31 other teams that think they know football. There's 31 other teams that have lots of busts that are on their roster. And I'm not saying he's a bust. Never said that. You know, when I discussed that trade, what did I say? I said there's about a 60% chance that it's just an outright bad trade. I said I think there's probably, and I'm just guessing at the numbers that I said at the time, but I think I said that there was about a 25% chance that you're probably happy with the trade, about a 15% chance that he actually is that good of a player. You know, and then the balance of it is that you look back at it and say, okay, that was a bad trade. That's not the part that people listen to, though. It's as if you're telling someone what to do. I'm not telling the Jets to not draft a guard. I'm not telling them not to trade up for a guard. I'm just telling you the odds are against it working out. I think when I was looking at my timeline, or if not on my timeline, but no, I'm sure it was definitely on my timeline, I think. You know, Bob Wischusen, who's a great radio guy for the Jets, you know, and he even said as a comment, don't think these guys that are saying this don't know the numbers. He basically said they're probably going to be right. But he liked the pick. You know, he liked the player, and he wasn't saying that it was, you know, he was just trying to illustrate, this isn't people talking out of the side of their mouth. There's reasons behind what is being said as to why it was a bad trade, bad selection. You know, that's the whole point of it. You're giving people options, and you're giving them the most information possible to make those decisions. For whatever reason, there's a reluctance on it. And I think, you know, and I know I've talked about this before too. The part of the problem is the communication on, I think, the end of most of the work that we all do for certain things comes across as, and I try not to do this, but I know I do, and I know I did with that trade talk, certainly. You kind of come up with the talking point or the attitude of, okay, I did this. This is what I found. I'm right. And the thing is, you're not always right. A lot of times you're going to find other things, like in that story that was mentioned before, about how you didn't take into account processing speed, you know, processing time, where you do change your opinions. You know, there's changing variables within the league. You know, if I go back and I pull up numbers or things to do from 2003, it's a completely different league. There's almost no value in that. You know, and I guess part of this too is there's negativity because there's this push on the media side from it. But it's almost as if, you know, where people will talk about analytics Twitter or something like that. But it's a lack of communication, I think, in terms of explaining that you're not saying that it's not black and white. You know, it's not yes or no. It's shades of gray. It's different outcomes. No different than when you talk about the coronavirus stuff. And it's not to compare the two, but, you know, people will bring up the early missteps, whether it was by the Trump administration, the CDC, whoever it is. Nobody should get completely blamed for any of that stuff because it was completely unknown. They were working with the information that they had at the time and whatever they thought was best suited based on that information. Information changed. When information changes, you change with the information. You don't keep insisting that things are correct. You look to see how you can modify. You look to see how you can improve. And you look to see where you went wrong. It's no different. And I think we do a poor job of doing that. And I think the other thing is that, and it's very hard to do. You know, people only have a limited amount of time to consume a podcast. People only have a limited amount of time to consume a video. People have very limited attention spans for reading stuff. But I know one of the things that helped me with contracts was always using examples, really trying not just to pinpoint one example, but try to pinpoint multiple examples. Try just to, instead of it just being like, well, I found this out, try to bring attention to things that maybe people relate to, maybe people relate with. You know, if you're going to do some type of study on quarterbacks, for example, maybe one of the better things to do is to outline who fits into what spot. Because then you start seeing names and you start being like, wait a minute, like, I remember that. Oh God, yeah, I remember that one. You know, I forgot all about that. I think sometimes that might be a better thing, you know, to do as well. You know, I think the game probability models have been a little bit of a problem only because people will pick up so much on when they're wrong. And that, I think that's also been a negative because when they're wrong, it looks bad. When you assign something a 99% chance outcome, and most of the time they probably shouldn't be 99%, and you have a couple of them that go wrong. You know, the thing to me is a game probability model. All that tells me as a team is if I'm on the losing end of that, if I'm on the, you know, the 1% chance of winning, I have to change the way I'm playing. Those models are built on standard ways of playing, right? They're built on the fact that if you're down 17 early in the fourth quarter, most teams will probably take the philosophy of we got to get this down to 10. 10 is manageable. We need to stop the bleeding. Gain momentum, get a big drive, get score 7 points, get this game down to 10. And they'll run their typical offense. The other team is probably a little bit lax. They'll take 6-7 minutes to score a touchdown. So you've got the game down to 10. You've got Troy Aikman saying, whoa, now we got a game. You know, Buck is in there saying something like that. Aikman's saying he can feel that momentum shift. You know, it's only two more possessions, they'll get it done. It's like you just took 7 minutes off the clock to score 7 points. That's why the probability model is probably still saying 99%, give or take a little bit. You need to score in 2 minutes. That changes the model. That breaks the model. That breaks tendencies. That breaks the rule. That breaks the norm. That's what those things should be for. And I think a lot of times when you look into these games where the model is completely off, it's probably because one of those teams didn't approach it normal, you know, or something just went haywire with turnovers. But we don't analyze it that way. We don't defend it. You just kind of go with the defense, well, you know, it's at 99%, 97%, you know, things happen. We don't say it's 100, right? But instead of letting people, I think, take over the criticism of it, I think it's probably better to go out and explain exactly what happened as best you can. You know, it's hard to do because the initial criticism comes so fast. You know, but my take on all those models is as a team, I think they'd be very valuable for me to determine how I'm playing in the fourth quarter because I need to change my approach. I can't be a traditional team. I can't look to get it down to 10, hold the other team to no points over two possessions, hope they don't bleed the clock, and then find a way to score two more times in, I don't know, 5 minutes with probably no timeouts, you know, and, you know, things like that. But yeah, it was just kind of something to where I don't think that stuff is going to catch on until you get probably a younger group of people, you know, in positions of power, I think, to where they're more open maybe to listening to more and more stuff. I think teams are very open to listening to stuff about medical. I think they're very open to listening to anything about sports science, anything that is dealing with equipment, anything that is dealing with training techniques, anything like that, because that's something that they don't control, they don't know enough about, or, you know, everyone's got staffs for certain things, but that's something that they're willing to look to the outside for because there's a feeling that that's different. But when it comes to the other stuff, I think there's a feeling that it's stuff that they can do themselves. They'll just figure things out on their own. I don't know. It was just kind of weird, and it just kind of came to me with that if you can walk someone into thinking that they control it, they create it, they can mold it how they want, I really think there'd be much wider spread acceptance of different concepts from the outside to playing much more of a role on the inside when it comes to roster management, roster construction, drafting decisions, in-game management, in-game decision-making, without stripping people of their independence, without stripping people of their ability to think, without stripping people of their ability to make decisions that do go against the grain, you know, that do go against the norm. But there's got to be a way that, you know, we could talk more people into stuff. And, you know, it's just one of those things. You know, now, is it possible that a team like the Eagles or a team like the Browns are probably a little bit better suited for it right now than the Eagles, you know, could take off to the point where it kind of becomes a model and teams start to try to piggyback off it? I guess so. But I don't know. I'm not even sure on that one, you know, if that'll be the case. But anyway, I just wanted to share that just from my little experience with this and, you know, what I thought was just more of just more feedback, more direct feedback, I think, on these topics and kind of an open forum about it, which just gave me, I think, a little bit more a clearer picture as to why maybe some of these things aren't taken into account as much as pretty much, you know, other things in the league. All right. So anyway, let's get into our contract stuff now and away from that, since that went on forever. Ryan Ramczyk just killed it on his contract. $19 million a year with upside that'll get him over to $20 million, basically if he's an all-pro and happens to play on the left side of the field. You know, it's an amazing contract here. Let me just pull up the numbers. So he'll make $28 million in year one, $42 by year two, $59 by year three, $77 through year four, $96 through year five if he gets there. That is a left tackle contract. I'm just going to pull up a couple of these. Let's pull up Stanley's deal. To give you an idea, now Stanley got the big payout right up front. That was basically their push on that one. As you get to year three, it's a 63 to 59, 78 to 77, 98 to 96. So, I mean, that's a, you know, it's close to that once you get to the third year of that deal. Let me take a look at some other positions here, or some other players. Let me just think of some players to take a look at. You've got Colton Miller recently signed for 18, I think. So, Colton Miller is 29.4 through year one. Ramczyk passes him in year two, 42 to 41.8. Year three, it's 59 to 54. Now, Colton Miller does get to go to free agency earlier. That's just a three-year extension, so you do have that gets taken into account. You also have the Garrett Bowles deal, which was done by Denver. Bowles was 21 through year one versus 28 here, 42 to 38, 59 to, I mean, this just blows it out of the water, just completely blows it away. it's a left tackle contract. I don't think Ramczyk has really ever been considered a left tackle. You know, this is different than Lane Johnson. You know, people will bring up Lane Johnson having always been a right tackle. Lane Johnson was drafted to be a left tackle. Lane Johnson was drafted to take over for Jason Peters. Jason Peters never got old. Jason Peters never needed to leave the Eagles until recently. And at that point, it was like, well, we don't need to move the right tackle over left tackle. Let's just develop another left tackle. So he was paid only because he was drafted to be a left tackle. And if he went to free agency, he was going to be viewed as a left tackle in free agency. If Ryan Ramczyk goes into free agency, I am confident that he was going to be looked at as a right tackle. This is the one of the main reasons that Orlando Brown wants to play left tackle. I know there's the whole thing where, you know, he said he wanted to do it for, I think, his father. Reality is the money is in being a left tackle. Because if you look at the legitimate right tackle contracts, Conklin's at 14 as the top guy. After that, you know, you don't really have anybody. You got a franchise player. You got Bulaga at 10, Collins at 10, Fant at 9-2, Trent Brown at 9. There's no market here. You know, Ramczyk's market as a right tackle is maybe 15. This tells me a couple of things here. Number one, I have to think that the New Orleans Saints are looking at him as a left tackle, that he is going to be a left tackle unless Terron Armstead goes and signs for $12 million a year on his next contract. Terron Armstead is a free agent after this season. I have no idea if Ramczyk can play the left side, at least at that kind of level. I have no clue on that at all. These numbers are clearly the numbers of a left tackle. If they're still planning on having Armstead on the team, you know, I don't know why Armstead would sign for anything less than $23.5 million a year. You know, that's what Trent Williams got in San Francisco. You know, Trent Williams is 33 years old. How old is Armstead? 32? Armstead is 30, so he'll be 31 next year. That's part of me says that, you know, that they're looking at this as this guy will be their left tackle, and unless Armstead comes back cheap, because if not, you're looking at investing $45 million basically into this position, into the two offensive tackle positions. That's absurd. That is really crazy, and it doesn't make any sense. It's like, if that's what you're going to do, re-sign Armstead, and then you work with Ramczyk on a legitimate right tackle contract. This is like the backwards way to do it. The other possibilities here, and this gets into the Saints roster issues right now. Two things. One, they create $5.5 million in cap room with the deal. That gives them the ability to bring in a veteran to play on the team. You know, whether that's a cornerback, maybe you revisit. I don't know, is Janoris Jenkins on a team right now? No, they didn't want to cut him. I think they paid him, so those offsets won't kick in. Yeah, Jenkins is on the Titans. You know, maybe like a Richard Sherman or someone like that, you know, you bring in. Maybe they're thinking of something like that. It's a possibility. The other thing that's possible is they have so many free agents next year. They have to have their franchise tag at their disposal. They have to, because they just have too many players who are possibly going to go. So maybe you kind of get backed into this deal. You get stiff-armed into it because it was the deal you could get done. You needed to get something done. You know, you didn't get Lattimore done yet. You didn't get Williams done. You don't have a quarterback under contract. So I think that could play a role as well. But, you know, with all these deals, you know, it's a weird thing. You know, that might get the Williams deal done. I don't think he's – let me see if he's on the 1 year still. That's a bad franchise tag. Yeah, they didn't void him out yet. You know, it really does. It puts you in a bad position with all these players. You just went so far over market for Ramczyk. how can you justify on your left tackle not going far over market? How do you justify on your safety not going far over market? How do you justify on your cornerback not going far over market? Like, how? Like, you know, every deal that you do, every decision that you make has a consequence to it within your team. You know, everything that you do is going to impact everyone else. It's going to impact your other contracts if you have smart people negotiating. The only argument the Saints can make with any of those players at all is that he's going to be our left tackle in 2022. We paid him to be a left tackle. That's the only argument that they can have if they look to get a reasonable deal. I don't know if that's what's going to be the case or not. They paid him the same amount of money they paid Michael Thomas. You know, and that was like a fight with maybe not a fight. It's not the right word. But, you know, Thomas wanted to be over 20. And the Saints, you know, for all the grief that I give the Saints for this refusing to ever say no and, you know, the constant restructuring and everything else, for the most part, all of their contracts that they do are pretty reasonable. It's just the excess amount of signings. But the contracts themselves are reasonable. This one is not. This one is a fantastic deal for him, unless he's moving to right left tackle, in which case it's still a fantastic deal for him, having never really played left tackle. So, I mean, it's just a I don't know. I'm really surprised at their decision to do this. I think it's just not good for whatever they're going to do. In terms of the rest of the league, yeah, this is a big thing. And now what's going to happen is you are going to have a number of teams that can somehow say, this guy's a left tackle. And that was easy to do with Lane Johnson because he was a left tackle. It's not so easy to do here. You know, it is not easy at all, you know, to kind of come up with that. I think now, if you are the Chiefs, if you're the Vikings, I think, is O'Neal a free agent coming up? Yeah, next year. If you're those teams that have free agents coming up, and Brown's going to be a left tackle, so maybe that one I shouldn't bring up. Let me see if anyone else is a free agent that I'm not thinking of. You know, O'Neal would probably be the one. Oh, the Panthers, I forgot about their right tackle. They have him on the franchise tag right now. So really, those are the two. Brown, having never played it down at left tackle. I mean, I guess that could play a role a little bit as well. But if you're the Panthers and you're the Vikings, or maybe the Chiefs, maybe even the Colts, Smith, is he a free agent? Yeah, he's a free agent too. You know, if you're those teams, you look at this, I don't know how easy it's going to be to make that argument that this is not a legitimate contract. You might not have to top it, but you're going to have to go somewhere in between 14 and 19. And that's a massive jump when you were probably thinking your final numbers were going to be 15, 14, 13, 12, you know, something like that for those other players. Brown, like I said, Brown was moving off that. I don't know what you do if you're one of those teams. You know, if you're the Panthers negotiating with your right tackle, can you make that argument? Or are you going to have to wait until next year and see what happens with Armstead? Which is tough because the players are going to be free agents at that point. Though you would assume in the case of the Saints, Armstead's deal has a ton of dead money attached to it. Let me see how much. Because they voided his deal out like there was no tomorrow. He has $13 million dead, so he'll get re-signed before – if he's going to re-sign, it'll be before free agency. You know, but otherwise, you probably have to see his contract voids the last day of the league year, so that they do have all the way until then before they take on the dead money. But if no extension is worked out for him, you know, then you can probably say, okay, they're clearly moving him to left tackle, and it'd be obvious at that point. But you got to negotiate ahead of time with these guys. You've got a one-day window when it comes to that, unless the Saints just come right out and say it. It's a real tricky spot, and you've got a couple of teams now who really are going to determine, is this going to be the right tackle market, and right tackle, left tackle is now the same market, because that's what this makes it. This is going to make it to where there's no differentiation between the two positions. Or is this simply going to be an outlier deal where you say that, yeah, he was a left tackle and he was paid as such. I'm just going to see who is left. Let me just see how these all rank. Just to give you an idea, because I know a couple people were like, oh, there's no difference between the two. It's always been, or recently has always just been about talent. And I just don't buy that at all. So here are the top salaries. I'm just going to read you position-wise going down. We'll do top 20 or so. So the top 20 players, let's just take a look by salary. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 left tackles, 4 right tackles. So it has nothing to do with, oh, who are good tackles? There's good right tackles. They just don't get any money. This might be a real game changer. Lane Johnson was never a game changer. Never. Did it help left tackles? It helped left tackles. It was never a game changer. Trent Brown in the Raiders, never a game changer, because he was able to position himself as a left tackle that they just happened to move to the right side. Now, if you eliminate the Lane Johnson deal from the equation, and before the Ramczyk deal, Conklin ranked number 15. I'm sorry, 14 if we get rid of the Ramczyk deal. 14 among all tackles. Moten on the tag would have been 15. That's just a one-year deal. Collins was number 20. I think if we take the Ramczyk deal out, would have been number 20 at 9.2 or 10. I think he's at 10 a year. Yeah, he's at 10 a year, among all offensive tackles. So, no, the right tackle market, completely 100% different than the left tackle market until 2 days ago. Now the ball is in the court of everybody else. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens here. I think just absolutely 100% fascinating to see what happens with these other players, because the Saints have put a lot of pressure on a lot of other teams. If the Saints move him to left tackle and he's a good left tackle, well, you know what? Then the Saints did a pretty good thing, because they're going to screw over the Panthers. They're going to screw over the Colts. They might screw over the Vikings. And certainly the Panthers are within their own division. Vikings are within the conference. So, that's a little bit of one-upsmanship if that was kind of the thought. I don't know if it really was. But these other teams absolutely have to paint this as, he's a left tackle. Now you're just going to have to work up a little bit more from Conklin than you probably expected before, because there's always going to be uncertainty as to whether he's a left tackle or not. But I don't know if you're going to have that time. You almost need, the best thing that could probably happen for these teams would actually be for something to happen to Armstead, this year, to where they had to tip their hand and move him, now to left tackle. That would really be it. So it's interesting. Interesting to say the least, but it's a great deal for him. And I would say it's the worst deal the Saints have done since the Junior Gallette deal. It's not as bad as that one. That one was just a bad decision. This one is a much better player. There's no risk involved, I think, in this one. In terms of, the player not working out. But as a contract, just to evaluate it independently within the market and everything else, this was something. And all these guys who signed, when we talked the other week about Xavier Howard and being upset with contracts and Hunter and Minnesota, if you're some of those guys that I mentioned before, Colton Miller and Garrett Bowles, and if you go down that list of players like a Deion Dawkins, maybe Decker, those players, Ronnie Stanley, all of these players, Donovan Smith, that was a terrible deal, I think. All of these players are going to look at this and go, what did we do? Like, why, what? we should all be over 20. So, you know, a great deal for Ramczyk, though. So good for him. You know, he's a terrific player. But yeah, that's something. So yeah, that'll be an interesting one to watch. All right, let's take a look at questions here. So let's pull them up. First batch. Square one. Teams are routinely happy to cut players when the dead money is only 5 to 20% of the remaining contract. Are teams too quick to structure contracts that will result in players being predictably cut in their final years? And are teams too blasé about eating $1 million here and $2 million there? No, I don't think so at all. I've done a lot of studies on dead money. The concept of dead money being really, really bad is overblown. Dead money becomes bad when you become afraid of it. There's two things. When you become afraid of it, when you do hit that excess point where it really hurts your team, okay? That would be based on where the cap should be this year, probably around $30 million in dead money, give or take a little bit. That would be like a really compromised position. But I think there's a lot of teams, like for years, the Buccaneers, for example, who just run from dead money, right? They just won't even utilize anything in their contracts that allow them to try to add more players to their team. And essentially, all you're doing is taking a dead money charge right now by, you know, not using signing bonuses. You're almost kind of like, it's a way, I guess, to hedge your bet, but you never really maximize your roster in any given season by doing that. You know, very rarely would you be able to do that. I think the problem is where teams are fearful of, let's say you had to cut. Now, I know Carson Wentz is a little extreme because that number was so big, but a more manageable number than that, to where you still get concerned over, say, someone's got $15 million dead. And you get concerned about that because, one, it looks really bad because you just signed this guy last year or 2 years ago, whatever it is, and now you've got all this dead money, you know, and you're eating that cost, and you paid him all this money ahead of time. This is the Bengals philosophy. They're the ones who typify this the most. And you're just like, I paid this guy this much. I've got to be able to get something out of him this year. This is the year we're getting something out of him. It's like, if you didn't get something out of him when he was 27, you didn't get something out of him when he's 28. Sure as hell ain't getting something out of him when he's 29, but you still have him on the roster. You know, you're better off taking the dead money. You're better off doing what the Panthers did with Bridgewater, where you're paying it to get rid of him. You know, because in the long run, that's cheaper. The Eagles dumping Wentz in the long run is cheaper than keeping him and hoping that they can fix him. So I don't think that I don't think it's a problem with the way teams in general structure their deals, but I think teams should be less fearful of dead money than they are. You should never be a team that constructs a roster that would never, ever, ever contain dead money. You're minimizing instead of maximizing your budget. You're not maximizing the strength of your roster, and you're chasing sunk costs a lot of times when you do that. And quite frankly, you're showing a lack of confidence in your own ability, I think, too. If there's a happy medium where we talk about risk. You can develop models just based on contract histories, even if you wanted to, where you can determine the outcomes of every single player on your team. You know, in this given year, you could probably, you know, this year is pretty much set, but you could probably look forward to 2022. And if I'm the Jets, I could probably look at all the players on my roster, and you could probably assign a probability level, some of whom have never played a down before for you, as to what the odds are that they're going to be on your team next year, not on your team. You can do it for 2022, 2023, 2024. And you can adjust those each and every year, obviously. But I would look at it as if, okay, I've got these contracts now, or you would do this probably before you actually structure the deals. But I would look at that right now and I would say, okay, the odds are my dead money is going to be X in 2022. It's going to be Y in 2023. It's going to be Z in 2024. And as long as those numbers are manageable, that's perfectly fine. And, you know, if some players beat the system, don't get cut, you know, you may be a little bit better off. Some players might bust out. You end up cutting them earlier, like a Le'Veon Bell kind of deal. Hopefully you have something to offset that. But that's the way that I would kind of play on my contracts, and the way that I would look at dead money is I would look at by using kind of very basic models to determine my optimum contract structures for players that I sign. And as long as my dead money comes under a certain threshold in every year, whatever that number is, I'm not sure off the top of my head what that would be, I'm perfectly fine with it. Shaky says, was there a change to the CBA impacting the cap hit from trades? I kept hearing about post-June 1 trades, and I thought that a trade forced a team to take an immediate hit for all dead money on a traded player. No, that's always been the rule. The June 1 has – it always applied whether it was a trade or a cut. The difference is that – and this is a problem with wording that people use. There's an actual rule in the CBA – where you're essentially allowed what's called a post-June 1 designation, or post-June 2, whatever it is. Post-June 1 designation. And what that allows you to do is cut a player in March or April and designate him post-June 1, which means you carry him for accounting purposes as if he's on your roster, and then you're allowed to split the cap hit the following year. You can't do that with a trade. There's no such thing as a post-June 1 trade designation to where you can trade the player before June 1st but have it accounted for as if it happens after June 1st. So you have to wait until June 2nd to execute a trade to get that kind of salary cap treatment. The reason that it kind of, I guess, got talked about was it was pretty clear the Falcons needed to wait on Jones to trade him because of cap considerations, because their cap is that bad this year that there was no way they could probably move him before. So they needed to move him after. And a lot of times when you deal with kind of star players, usually you want to trade those players as early as possible. You know, you want draft picks this year for those players. And by having to wait until after June, you don't get them until the following year. And teams, a lot of times, for wide receivers, maybe not as much. You know, you're not even in training camp yet. But when it comes to positions like quarterback and stuff, they want those players in the building right at the start of OTAs. You know, they want them there March and April, you know, to be around, be talking with teammates, be conversing with the wide receivers, meeting their offensive linemen. So teams don't want to wait, so you don't get that option. But people started to talk about this as if it was a post-June 1 trade, making it like it was a fancy designation. No, this has just always been the rule. Mike says, Urban Meyer was fined $100,000 for OTA violations. Is it likely Urban will actually pay this, or will the team cover it? Is it the type of thing that can be agreed beforehand for transgressions? I don't really know. I don't deal with the coaching contract stuff. I would guess it's probably docked out of his pay. I would guess. But nah, I'm not really sure. Steezo says, following the Ramchek deal, what do you think Brian O'Neill extension as a new top of the right tackle market change things? I would think so. I guess we'll see. I can't say that I've dug deep on, you know, usually I don't really even think much about the right tackle. So to be honest, I haven't really gone very deep on even thinking about any of these players with it. But, you know, as I said before, I think the onus is now on those handful of teams to really determine, is your right tackle really going to be valued high or not? You kind of run into an issue to where if it is an or not, you know, league-wide, and you punched up on these guys, you almost put yourself at a competitive disadvantage if the rest of the league doesn't continue the trend. And sometimes that happens. You know, years ago, there was a big push for guard salaries in the NFL. This is going back to when guys like Fanica and stuff were in the league. And you started to see all these teams really, really go up on these salaries for guards. And then teams started to say, wait a minute, this isn't a smart thing. And you had a couple teams that got stuck with these big contracts for guards while the rest of the league went back to kind of a normal salary range. You know, it was a market that pulled back. I guess you could say the same about running backs, maybe a little bit, but it was definitely something for guards. Now, guards have punched back up again now in the last, you know, 3 years or so. But I could see with right tackles where you get a short-term bump and then you start saying, well, what the hell were these teams paying for? It's just too much money, especially when you got to pay a left tackle a lot of money. We're better off just going in the draft. Aaron says, what do you see O'Neill in Minnesota get? Oh, same question. So same basic answer there. Which of the 2018 QBs do you expect to sign next and for how much? That's a real interesting one. I don't know which one will sign first. I'm going to guess the the one who is probably under the most pressure to sign is probably Lamar Jackson. I think Jackson probably looks at himself, and he's negotiating his own deal, as being in a riskier situation than some of the other players. I think the threat of injury is higher. I think the threat of ineffectiveness is not the right word, but he's not a traditional quarterback. So I think that there is, you know, maybe a little bit of a concern that could be there. So, you know, and he didn't get much money coming out. He was like the last pick or right at the end of round one. So he didn't get as much money as the other two guys either. So I guess if you put a gun to my head, I would probably say Lamar Jackson, and I would guess $41 million a year, probably right above Dak. And then you have to just see how that structure works out. You know, with him doing his own deal and who he has advising him, I don't know who that is, you know, to see how he makes out. I think the Ravens will be good with him. I think they'll be honest with him. But I would guess that he'll be the next one, you know, and then I guess of the other two, I guess Mayfield. You know, I feel like Mayfield and Allen have the most to gain by playing out a year. Both can also lose. You know, Jackson's teams have been – I mean, the Bills have been successful too, but Jackson's had two successful teams. He does have an MVP. So I don't know, you know, with the other two, if that's as apparent. You know, I guess we'll see how that all shakes out here. But if you put a gun to my head, I'll say Jackson. Turner says, favorite beer. My favorite beer, even though I don't really drink it very often because it's way too strong. And obviously right now, you listen to me, I'm talking about drinking Michelob Ultra. No, my favorite one is actually the Dogfish Head 90 Minute IPA. I used to really like to get that one. Now that one hits me a little too much. I actually haven't had the 90 in a while. But that's my favorite one of the beers that I actually drink much more of. It's the Dogfish Head 60 is probably my favorite beer, you know, that I drink a lot. But the 90 minute one, for occasions where I don't really have to do anything the next day, or, you know, don't have anything really going on with the family or anything else, maybe I'll do the 4-pack of the 90 minute and then see how things go. Now, if we have one of these days, you know what? If we do a late night Twitter Q&A one of these days, if I can ever figure out how to hook up my video camera to run some stuff on there, maybe I'll do a little video thing and we'll do a some 90 minute IPAs during the course of the night, where we'll do a little live Twitter session. Native Son, how will his contract impact the guard market in terms of salary next season? I'm guessing that's about Ramczyk. I don't know if that will. I know that right now guards are paid higher than right tackles. So, I mean, it could have an impact on it. I don't think so. I think that teams would be able to make a case that there's more value being placed just on the offensive tackle in general. And I don't think the guard numbers would dramatically change. But who knows? It's also possible, I guess, that it could. You know, I'd have to look to see who the guards are, who are free agents. But I can't discount it. You know, maybe I might be discounting that too much. That's probably a good point. WFT News. Hello, are there updated numbers for the value of draft picks according to salaries of players selected those positions go on to make? Is it fair to use this data to compare veteran values? Example, Fitzpatrick would be sixth overall, sixth round. To clarify, I'm hoping to add context to how a team values its players differently to give perspective on roster battles. For example, Gardner Minshew would have no chance of beating Daniel Jones in a camp competition. Okay, so this is about the article that was really the original article for the book that Brad and I did on the draft. So I would say that you can probably, if you're talking about blind rookies versus a veteran player, I think you can use those numbers. I would use whatever the stuff is that Brad and I have in the book. I think we have percentages in there. I don't remember if we do or don't, to be honest. You could use this, what's here. I would take a look to see what we have in the book, because we did a better system of this in the book that made the valuations position independent. So in other words, you could take a quarterback and plug him in and you would get a very different outcome than if you took a running back and plugged that player in. But yeah, I think you probably could use that to say that, all right, you know what? If you have a blind rookie, you know, a rookie who hasn't played, you know, or in the case of Minshew and Jones, if you had two players who were both rookies at the same time, yeah, the later draft pick would not beat out the young, the higher draft pick. You know, he would basically need an opportunity to get in there and to prove that he could be better. I think you can use it that way for until the point where the players actually start playing and performing at an NFL level. Because, you know, if you look at those salaries on there, you know, and again, that the article itself that was written is not position independent. So that this is, you know, the average value of the number one pick at the time when I wrote this was worth $14.6 million. A quarterback would be worth like $30 million. Running back would probably be worth like $8 million. Your blind pick here, you know, blind pick completely would be worth about $14.6 million. You know, by the second year after you've seen that player play, you might have a valuation on that player of 22 because he's better than the average expectation. And, you know, for a player like Daniel Jones, for example, you're still chasing that, right? That first year, a lot of times that even if the player plays at a much lower number, you would probably still look at this and say, well, yeah, he's a 14.6, you know, or he's a 20, or, you know, whatever the number is for that position. They would probably still look at it that way. Year three, it's all dependent at that point, except for bad teams. And I don't know, maybe Daniel Jones is being looked at that way right now too. Then you have to modify those numbers for the level of play. So I guess the way that I would look at it is for a rookie, yeah, I think these are the accurate style numbers if you adjust them for position, if you wanted to compare them to whether or not they were going to win a battle against a veteran player. For year two, I would look at it that the value could go significantly up, but probably not significantly down unless there was like a disaster. You know, that person goes crazy, like the guy that the Titans drafted, you know, that you just had to get rid of. So, you know, players like that. Year three, I think then you could be way up or way down. You know, by that point in time, you're far removed from the unknown portion of the equation. He's now kind of a known player. So that's how I would look at that. All right, let's take a look here. A couple more questions, then we'll be done for the night. Daniel says, if I were someone wanting to get into football analytics, what would be the best resource to use and how do I get off the ground in that respect? So I would just follow all the guys who do a lot of that stuff, depending on what you want to work with. You know, the NFL Faster programs, that kind of stuff is probably good to use. Working with different data, looking at entering competitions that are there, putting stuff out in the Twitter space and interacting with people who do stuff in terms of analytics. Those are people you just want to converse with. Just get in the conversations and become part of the conversations. You will wind up joining a group of people that discuss that stuff a lot, and you can get your stuff retweeted and put out there. But I think if that's what you're looking to do, you probably want to work with the packages that are existing. Look at the data bowl kind of stuff and get active. You know, don't just sit there and do some stuff, but try to be, I guess, a little unique in what you do. We can only read so many times about how running backs kind of suck. You know, so I think what you want to do is you want to look for your own way to spin some of the stuff rather than taking things that have been redone and just kind of rewriting it. Now, you might find something completely new that hasn't really been discussed. And maybe sometimes that's a good starting point to just work with the data and look at presenting the numbers and, you know, how you can build some type of graphics or something to go along with it. But I would say that, you know, just become part of that community. Just interact. Doesn't matter if people don't follow you. Just comment. When you see them post, comment and bring something up and say, well, this is something that I did. And people will look at it. People read things. Football coach says, how do you qualify the Pats cap health? I hated their free agency. Absolutely hated it. It was just no thought of anything. You know, but the point that you're bringing up in the question here, they don't have a lot of free agents coming up. You know, that's probably true. They also don't have a quarterback under contract, the veteran. You know, so you're banking on the rookie being good. You're hoping for, obviously. I would guess that you would look at them and probably say that they're average. I would say probably average short term and probably top third of the league, maybe top seven or eight long term. You know, long term meaning through like 2024, because they do have a rookie quarterback. So you have a cheap player under contract at the most expensive position in football. But I think for next year, I think they're still going to be a little bit compromised, not the word, because like I said, I think it's average. But they'll be a little bit burdened, I think, by the nonsense that they did in free agency this year. Mark says, why aren't Sherman and KJ Wright signed? I think KJ Wright is probably looked at as a older player who is a Seattle player and nothing else. Sometimes that happens with veteran players. There are other teams that I think look at veterans from certain teams, even if they're notable veteran players who have spent an entire career with a team playing in a certain scheme. And they look at those players and say, you know, it's going to end up being money that we spend on someone who is going through the motions or doesn't, you know, fit in as well as we anticipated. And if you're going to take that chance, take a chance on somebody who's younger. So I think that is a big reason for him being unsigned at this point. I think Sherman's has to do with a couple things. One, he's been hurt, two of the last 4 years? If you look at, let me see, Richard Sherman. Yeah, 9 games in 2017 and 5 games last year. I don't think there's as much concern that he's a system player. I think you can find a place for him easily. But he is 33 years old. It's a position where if you're not healthy, it's a negative. Peterson, I think, signed for 8. And Peterson is a little bit younger. Was only really hurt the 1 year, though he is not the same. He's not the same player, but was probably looked at as a little bit more versatile. But I think the thing with Sherman, too, I do think that there is probably a feeling that Richard Sherman is got one eye on football, one eye on his post-football career. I think he's going to do a very good job in like as an analyst or whatever space he wants to work in as a media presence. I think he's going to do a very good job in that regard. And I kind of feel as if there's a little bit of a feeling that maybe he might be a little more invested in that than he would be in football. And there might be a worry that if he's not in the right situation. So, for example, a lot of people linked him with the Jets at one point in time. They thought that was a good fit. If the Jets flop out, he may very well just check out. So he may be a player that's actually better suited to being like a mid-season signing to where you don't need 17 games out of him. Maybe you only need 8 plus the playoffs. And you know he's going to be engaged because you're bringing him into a good football team versus being an unknown. And I mean, I guess there's also the possibility of money too. You know, I thought Sherman took a terrible contract with San Francisco, but it's not like he didn't get paid at all. So, I mean, that I guess that could be a possibility too. John says, have you ever consulted with the EA Madden NFL team regarding the Fitzgerald Spielberger NFL trade values? If not, the team could really use your expertise in proving their AI draft logic. No, we've never spoken with them about it. I'd always be open to discussing those things. So if anyone knows anyone at Madden, feel free. No, I haven't played the Madden games in so many years. I wouldn't really know much about that. I am sure that their salary stuff is probably all kind of wacky. I would imagine the trade stuff is. However, I would say this. I don't think that the trade values that Brad and I have are not reflective of trade values in the NFL. They are reflected on the expected return on a trade in the NFL and probably should be closer to what teams use towards doing that in a complete fair and balanced trade, risk-free, whatever, what should be used. But the numbers that are more reflective of what is a legitimate trade in the NFL in terms of just trading draft picks, if that's kind of what you do in the Madden game, that's really the Rich Hill chart. That's much more reflective of the way that the NFL has gone with a lot of their trades. You know, but some of the other stuff, like if you're doing trades of veteran players, and I don't know, again, anything with the games, that probably wouldn't be hard to manipulate a little bit either, to make it realistic based on trades that have happened in the NFL in the last couple of years. So Madden, if you're listening, we're there. Let's see. Do I have anything else here? I think that's it. So I think that will do it for me. Happy 4th of July, everyone. Most of you probably won't listen to this till after the 4th of July. Hopefully I'll have it up before then, but we'll see. I'll be back hopefully next Friday or Saturday doing another podcast. Amazingly, I don't think Nelly made a peep during this, which is quite amazing. So Nelly, anything to say in closing? No. All right. So anyway, everybody have a great week, and I will talk to you all again soon.